Good morning. It's Monday, January 23rd, and this is the KBOO Morning News. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Blaine Palmer. Coming up on this program, is OSU trying to suppress the truth on logging?
The FBI might have goofed in the Brandon Mayfield case.
And President Bush may have ties to Jack Abramoff.
Today's weather, cloudy in the morning, then partly sunny, patchy fog in the morning, highs around 50, light wind.
Benton County is looking to become the first place in Oregon to develop a conservation plan to protect rare butterfly species and their prairie habitat.
Virus database has been updated.
Many threatened and endangered butterflies and the plants on which they feed. The county recently got a $500,000 grant from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's going to develop a plan that will protect the threatened species from degradation and enhance the places where they're found. Tom Kays with the Nonprofit Institute of Applied Ecology in Corvallis. That's one of the county's partners in the project. And he says the plan puts Benton County on the leading edge of prairie habitat restoration. Kays says if steps are taken to conserve butterfly habitat, it'll have a positive effect on the whole ecosystem.
Oregon State University has received a $3.6 million federal grant to study ways to restore sagebrush ecosystems across the West. The five-year project will study the plants and wildlife that make up huge stretches of western lands. They're called steppes that feature large, dry, open areas with few trees. The West contains 100 million acres of sagebrush steppe. Researchers say because of the invasion of non-native plants such as cheatgrass, sagebrush ecosystems has become one of the most threatened land types in the United States. Project coordinator Jim McIver says they are losing sagebrush steppe ecosystems at an alarming rate. McIver says land managers need better information on sagebrush ecosystems to make them more resilient.
Here's another story coming from Oregon State University. This university is trying to suppress one of their own graduate student studies. Daniel Donato's study questions logging after the Biscuit Fire. KBOO's Andy Seaton has the story.
It publishes a study by Daniel Donato on the recovery from the 2002 Biscuit Fire. Donato led a team of scientists from Oregon State University and the U.S. Forestry Service. They found that logging after the Biscuit Fire destroyed seedlings and littered the ground with highly flammable tinder. Donato is a graduate student from Oregon State University, but some professors at the OSU College of Forestry want the journal to withhold the study. Donald Kennedy, the top editor for Science, said there's no chance the research will be suppressed. Science editors had independent scientists review Donato's research before deciding to publish it. Kennedy said the OSU professors can respond to the study once it's been published. Donato said the authors stand behind their story. However, the paper's final version deletes one controversial sentence from the online version. Quote, "The results represented here suggest that post-fire logging may conflict with ecosystem recovery goals," unquote. The dean of the College of Forestry, Hal Sawasser, sent a memo to faculty questioning the conclusions of the research paper. OSU's College of Forestry has close ties to the timber industry, and they receive about 10% of their funding from a tax on logging. I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
Two tribes are convinced the Portland area is hungry for Las Vegas-style gambling. They are pushing separate casinos that would bring 5,000 slot machines, 500 hotel rooms, and more than 200 card tables within an interstate jaunt from downtown. The Cowlitz Indian Tribe and the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs expect their ventures to reap a combined $665 million a year, surpassing the gambling of all nine of Oregon's tribal casinos. Those projections don't faze economists, who agree the lucrative Portland-Vancouver market has plenty of room to grow. And after years of talk, both tribes have cleared critical regulatory hurdles, paving the way for possible federal approval as early as 2007. In the forested Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area, the Warm Springs envisions a low-slung riverfront destination the size of four Costco warehouses. Tribal leaders would build a new Interstate 84 interchange to handle an expected 3 million annual visitors, this from the Oregonian.
Because of errors at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Portland lawyer Brandon Mayfield was arrested in connection with the 2004 Madrid train bombings that killed 191 people. A recently released report from the Office of the Inspector General details the FBI's mistakes. FSRN's Julie Sabatier has more.
FBI fingerprint analysts relied on minute details in a print lifted from a bag of detonators to link Muslim American Brandon Mayfield to the Madrid train bombings, according to the Inspector General's report.
We're talking about human examiners, and as long as the human element is part of the equation, then there's always a potential for a mistake. And regrettably, that's what occurred in this case.
That's Paul Bresson, a public affairs specialist with the FBI in Washington, D.C. He says the human errors made in this case had to do with the unusual similarity between the fingerprints and not with bias related to Mayfield's Muslim faith.
There was no misconduct on the part of the FBI. And religion played no improper role, and there was no abuse or misuse of the Patriot Act.
The report makes it clear that FBI examiners were not aware of Mayfield's religion when they concluded he was the source of the fingerprint in question. Nor did they have knowledge of his wife, who is an Egyptian immigrant, or the fact that Mayfield had represented a convicted terrorist, one of the Portland Seven, in a child custody case. However, one examiner admitted that if the person identified had been someone without these characteristics, like the Maytag repairman, the lab might have re-examined their original conclusion with more skepticism and caught the error. Mayfield spent 2 weeks in custody and at least a month under covert surveillance before Spanish National Police correctly linked the print lifted from the bag of detonators to an Algerian national.
This case is a classic example of the manner in which the breach of the wall between intelligence and law enforcement that the Patriot Act allowed has harmed an innocent man.
Stephen Wax is a lawyer with the Federal Public Defender's Office in Portland, Oregon. He represented Mayfield after his arrest in May of 2004.
The National Security Administration, the CIA, the Department of Defense Intelligence Agency, the FBI Intelligence Unit, etc., has received information which has then been transmitted from its headquarters to its various field offices. Hundreds, thousands of people around the world have had access to it. It's been copied, recopied, and recopied, and it will be virtually impossible to make Mr. Mayfield whole in the sense of getting him back his privacy.
Mayfield has filed a civil suit against the FBI, the Department of Justice, and several individuals for the alleged violation of his civil liberties, as well as violations to the U.S. Constitution. For FSRN, this is Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
Anti-tax activists have begun a signature-gathering drive hoping to ask Oregon voters this fall to clamp a tightening limit on state government spending. If the measure wins a spot on the ballot, it will touch off what's expected to be a high-spending campaign battle between tax foes who want to restrict government spending and those who say such a limit would put schools and important social services at risk. Jason Williams of the Taxpayers Association of Oregon says thousands of petition sheets have been mailed to volunteers across the state asking them to help collect signatures for the spending limit. Williams says paid signature gatherers might be brought in to help round up more than 100,000 signatures needed to qualify the spending limit proposal for the ballot.
The Oregon Transportation Commission has approved pre-development agreements with Australian-based Macquarie Infrastructure Group for three private toll roads in the Portland area. Under the contracts, the state will pay the company as much as $20 million for feasibility studies of the projects. They include a Newburgh-Dundee bypass, widening the southern portion of Interstate 205, and a new Sunrise Corridor highway from Interstate 205 toward Damascus. Oregon's considering the partnership with Macquarie, the world's largest private operator of toll roads, because tax revenues have not kept pace with public demand for highways. Macquarie will do scoping studies on the I-205 and Sunrise projects to determine whether they're ready to develop now, are fatally flawed, or should be deferred. The Newburgh-Dundee bypass is further along. On that project, Macquarie will work with state and local groups to explore financing. A key question will be whether tolls could generate enough money, and if not, what funding sources could be tapped. Further negotiations and commission approval will be needed to move any of the projects to construction. The state has agreed to reimburse Macquarie as much as $20 million for its development costs, only if the projects do not move forward to construction.
Although President Bush says he doesn't recall meeting convicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff, the two have reportedly turned up in photos together. Both Washingtonian and Time magazines have reported the existence of about a half dozen photos showing the two together. Time reported on its website yesterday that its staff members have seen at least six photos featuring Bush and Abramoff, who has pleaded guilty to federal charges stemming from his lobbying practices and has pledged to cooperate with investigators. They appear to have been taken at White House functions, according to the reports. The White House has acknowledged that Abramoff attended some events at the executive mansion. Abramoff met a few times with White House staff and attended Hanukkah receptions in 2001 and 2002, but officials there have refused to disclose how many times he's been into the complex or what business he had there. The White House also has not released any photos featuring the president and Abramoff, who was declared a Bush pioneer for raising at least $100,000 for the Bush-Cheney 2004 re-election campaign. The White House, after playing down the Bush-Abramoff photos and the lobbyist ties to the president, criticized Abramoff for breaking the law.
A U.S. officer has been found guilty of the negligent homicide of an Iraqi general who is being held in custody, but a jury of six Army officers found that he was not guilty of the murder of Major General Abed Hamed Mawash in 2003. Chief Warrant Officer Louis Welshoffer now faces up to 3 years in jail for homicide. He was also convicted of dereliction of duty. Prosecutors say Mawash was bound, placed headfirst in a sleeping bag, and died with an officer sitting on him. It was one of a number of deaths of prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan that are under investigation by the U.S. military. At the beginning of the trial, defense lawyers called a witness who claimed he had overheard a juror coming under pressure from a senior officer and applied for the case to be dismissed because of unlawful command influence. The judge rejected that request. Mawash died while being held at Al-Qaim in Iraq near the Syrian border. This story from the BBC.
Troops and civilians at a U.S. military base in Iraq were exposed to contaminated water last year. Employees for the responsible contractor, Halliburton, couldn't get their company to inform camp residents, according to interviews and internal company documents. Halliburton, the company formerly headed by Vice President Dick Cheney, disputes the allegations about water problems at Camp Junction City in Ramadi. The allegations were made by Halliburton's own employees and documented in company emails. The company's former water treatment expert at Camp Junction City said that he discovered the problem last March. While bottled water was available for drinking, the contaminated water was used for virtually everything else. Another former Halliburton employee who worked at the base said there were numerous instances of diarrhea and stomach cramps. A spokeswoman for Halliburton said its own inspection found neither contaminated water nor medical evidence to substantiate reports of illnesses at the base. Halliburton's performance in Iraq has been criticized in a number of military audits, and congressional Democrats have contended that the Bush administration has favored the company with non-competitive contracts.
Congress is expected soon to approve legislation that requires states to place at least half of their welfare families in jobs or approved training programs. Only 10 states meet that requirement now, and some aren't even close. The data comes from the 2003 budget year, and some states, including Maryland, say their participation rates have improved since then. Wade Horn, the Bush administration's point man on welfare issues, says he's confident that states will do better if told they must. Horn cites Georgia as his prime example. In 2 years, it went from a 10% to a 55% work participation rate. Some people fear that states will improve their rates primarily by kicking people out of the aid program when they miss a job interview or fail to show up for job training. Work participation rates in Georgia improved when they moved away from its policy of two strikes and you're out. Georgia now reduces a recipient's benefits gradually instead of dropping them abruptly. If Congress moves ahead, states would have until October 1st to get their work participation requirements up to 50%. They also would have until 2007 before penalties would kick in. Depending upon a state's performance, the Federal Administration for Children and Families could reduce Washington's contribution and require the state to make up the difference. The latest statistics show the average work participation rate for all states and territories is 31%. A report by the Democratic staff on the House Ways and Means Committee said the new participation rates would pressure states to cut families off assistance.
Mining labor, industry, and lawmakers are united in demanding that a dangerous subterranean occupation be made safer. One day after the bodies of two missing miners were found in Aracoma Coal's Alma No. 1 mine at Melville, Governor Joe Manchin was crafting legislation that he wanted lawmakers to approve by tonight. West Virginia's congressional delegation and the National Mining Association and the United Mine Workers of America said that they too want a major overhaul of state and federal mine safety laws. UMW President Cecil Roberts said Congress and state legislatures must take steps to ensure existing regulations are strictly enforced. A Senate Appropriations Subcommittee scheduled hearings on mine safety today. Nationally, there were 22 mine deaths in 2005, a record low. Three of those were in West Virginia, the nation's second largest coal producer.
Several lawmakers yesterday said they'll press President Bush to justify his decision to allow domestic eavesdropping. Republicans have suggested that this criticism of broad executive authority puts the nation at risk. During the Sunday talk shows, lawmakers were responding to efforts by White House aide Karl Rove to make national security the top partisan issue in the November midterm elections. Rove made the comments about the time that the new audio tape warnings by Osama bin Laden were released, threatening an upcoming attack on the U.S. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan said in a statement later yesterday, "It's a limited, hot pursuit effort by our intelligence community to detect and prevent attacks." And he accused Democrats of making misleading and outlandish charges about this vital tool that helps us do exactly what the 9/11 Commission said we needed to do, connect the dots. John McCain, a Republican, told Fox News Sunday that the new threats emphasize a greater need for Bush to fully consult with lawmakers from both parties on the best strategy for spy programs within the confines of the law. But McCain questioned efforts to paint Democrats as weak on national security. It's election day north of the border. I think that was a little traditional Canadian music bringing us into this story. Canadians will decide whether to toss out the Liberal Party after 13 years and welcome the Conservatives. Polls indicate voters are ready for the change. Conservative leader Stephen Harper has pledged to cut the red tape in Canada's social welfare programs, lower the national sales tax, and give more autonomy to the country's 10 provinces and 3 territories. He's also pledging to patch up relations with the United States that have been damaged in part because of the Liberals' opposition to the war in Iraq. Liberals have accused the Conservatives of having a hidden agenda aimed at chipping away at abortion and gay rights. Prime Minister Paul Martin's minority government was toppled in a no-confidence vote following a corruption scandal.
Thousands of abortion opponents massed outside Minnesota's capital yesterday in one of several protests nationwide on the 33rd anniversary of the Roe v. Wade ruling. This is at a time of heightened hopes and fears over what a new face on the Supreme Court will mean for the decision establishing abortion rights. A crowd of sign waivers clad in parkas, winter boots, and collars turned up against a cutting wind to call for a ban on public funding of abortion. Many abortion opponents say they were heartened by President Bush's choice of Samuel Alito to replace Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, a moderate who was often the court's swing vote. Alito, who appears to have solid support from the Senate's Republican majority, refused during his confirmation hearings to agree with assertions by Democrats that Roe v. Wade was settled law, upsetting supporters of abortion rights and heartening opponents. In San Francisco, thousands of abortion opponents, shouldering signs with slogans such as "Peace Begins in the Womb," marched Saturday, while abortion rights supporters along the march route waved clothes hangers and shouted, "Bigots, go home." Similar demonstrations took place nationwide.
Evo Morales has been sworn in as Bolivia's first indigenous president, pledging to end 500 years of injustice against his people. He reaffirmed his pledge to recover the country's natural resources by renationalizing them. Morales has been a llama herder and coca leaf farmer and said the free market model did not work in Bolivia and that the privatization of basic services and natural resources should be reversed. He also acknowledged the magnitude of the task during his 5-year term as Bolivia still remains South America's poorest country. Morales is a fierce critic of the U.S. and sees his election as a triumph for indigenous peoples. On Saturday, Morales visited the Inca temple of Calasasia. Before thousands of supporters, he received the baton encrusted with gold, silver, and bronze that will symbolize his Indian leadership.
Passengers on the luxury Queen Mary II cruise ship are threatening mutiny after the ship set sail from Florida with a damaged propeller. They have said they will refuse to disembark when the ship reaches Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, next week to prevent it from continuing its journey. It has dropped three ports of call because it is running at a reduced speed after the accident. Cunard Lines, which operates the ship, says it has offered compensation. The world's largest liner is on a 38-day trip around South America. However, it is running 2 days behind schedule, with one of its four propulsor pods out of commission. The British-registered ship has to be towed back to Fort Lauderdale in Florida on January 17th after one of its motors hit an underwater channel. Passengers have reacted angrily to the change of plans. They are saying they were only told scheduled stops were canceled once the ship set sail from Fort Lauderdale. Many passengers plan to meet relatives at aborted destinations and have paid for hotels and sightseeing trips. This according to the...
The U.S. Navy says it has captured a number of suspected pirates in the Indian Ocean off the coast of Somalia. Piracy, including hijackings and hostage-taking, has become common off anarchic Somalia, where there has been no effective central government since 1991. Shipping companies say there have been 35 incidents of piracy off the Indian Ocean coast of Somalia in the past 9 months. The U.S. Navy reports that the Navy's fifth fleet, based in Bahrain and patrolling the Indian Ocean, got a report of an attempted act of piracy about 50 miles off the Somalia coast on Friday. The guided missile destroyer called the USS Winston Churchill went in pursuit of a suspect vessel, and when other efforts failed, Churchill fired warning shots to bring the boat to a halt. There have been a number of attacks by pirates off Somalia, some of the most dangerous waters in the world.
Nigerian militants who have kidnapped four foreign oil workers and attacked a Shell oil platform say they are preparing to carry out more raids. The rebel group says it wants more control over the Niger Delta region's enormous oil wealth and is demanding the release of two local leaders. Negotiations between the government and the rebels are said to be continuing. The rebel group, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, is demanding the release of a separatist leader being held on treason charges, as well as a former governor accused of corruption and money laundering. The previously unknown group has also reiterated a demand for compensation of $1.5 billion from the Shell oil company for pollution in the region. The group attacked a Royal Dutch Shell pumping station near the port of Wari last weekend, prompting the oil giant to withdraw 330 workers. Oil workers' unions in Nigeria have threatened to withdraw members from the main oil-producing region unless the government moves to improve security. This from the BBC.
Saudi King Abdullah met with Chinese President Hu Jintao in Beijing today. China is trying to secure overseas oil and gas reserves for its power-hungry economy. Abdullah's three-day visit was the first by a Saudi ruler since the two countries established diplomatic relations in 1990. Hu told Abdullah during the meeting at the Great Hall of the People in Beijing that the visit would help write a new chapter of friendly cooperation between China and Saudi Arabia in the new century. Reporters were asked to leave the room shortly after the talks began. Hu and Abdullah, who arrived in China yesterday, were expected to discuss cooperation in energy and trade, according to the official Xinhua News Agency.
African leaders gathered in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, today for the African Union summit amid a row over who should chair it for the next year. Sudan is the only country that has put its name forward. However, some fear Sudan's human rights record will undermine the image of the African Union. Apart from the leadership row, The members face issues ranging from armed conflict to famine, disease, and economic development. Africa is split down the middle over Sudan's candidacy. A leading organization campaigning for human rights has said it will be a disaster if Sudan and its president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, were to be chosen when the crisis over Sudan's Darfur region was deepening and Khartoum was accused of involvement in murder, rape, and other atrocities. More than 200,000 people have been killed in Darfur in the past 3 years, and 2 million people have been forced from their homes. This from the BBC.
Civil rights advocates in Virginia are challenging a state law that restricts prison inmates' access to public records. From Richmond, FSRN's Catherine Kopp reports.
Joseph Giratano, a hepatitis C-positive inmate at Virginia's Red Onion State Prison, filed a lawsuit this week to challenge a 1997 Virginia statute that prohibits prisoners from requesting government documents under the state's Freedom of Information Act. Giratano wanted to know if the treatment he was receiving was adequate, but he was denied the Freedom of Information request seeking copies of the prison's protocol for hepatitis C treatment. The lawsuit states Virginia is violating the constitutional right to equal protection and the right to access the courts. Michigan, Louisiana, and Texas have similar statutes excluding prisoners from FOIA rights. Several other states, including New Jersey and Ohio, put restrictions on what information a prisoner can request. For FSRN, I'm Catherine Kamp.
Authorities say a Southern Oregon man was arrested during a traffic stop this weekend after hurling his prosthetic legs at a state trooper. Joel Kaxetter of Chemult was a passenger in a vehicle that was stopped by a trooper for driving the wrong direction on Highway 97. When the trooper suspected the driver of drinking and driving, Kaxetter allegedly got out of the car and threatened the trooper. The trooper eventually brought Kaxetter to the ground. That's when the 53-year-old man reportedly threw his prosthetic legs at the trooper. Police say one leg hit the trooper in the chest and the other missed. Kaxetter was booked in the Klamath County Jail on suspicion of menacing, assaulting an officer, interference with an officer, criminal conspiracy, and resisting arrest. The driver was charged with driving under the influence and other charges.
That's the KBOO Morning News for Monday, January 23rd.
The weather for today, cloudy in the morning, then partly sunny, patchy fog in the morning. Highs around 50, light wind.
You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR.
You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer and engineer for this morning's newscast is Jim Thompson. Thanks to Julie Sabatier and Andy Seaton for their great reporting. The KBOO Morning News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. Jim Thompson is on the board, and I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Blaine.